Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director and Physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Many people have smoked marijuana, many have seen marijuana, but very few people have ever heard marijuana.
A Florida judge on Friday ruled that the state's ban on smokable medical marijuana is unconstitutional. Judge Karen Gevers of the Leon County Circuit Court wrote in her ruling that Florida residents have the right to use the form of medical marijuana for treatment of their debilitating medical conditions as recommended by their certified physicians. Apparently, however, within 10 minutes of the judge's order, the Florida Health Department appealed the ruling, resulting in an automatic stay. An Orlando attorney, who most of us know by name as John Morgan of the law firm Morgan & Morgan, had challenged the ban on smoking products and had filed the lawsuit on behalf of two terminal patients who said that smokable medical marijuana was more effective for their conditions than vaping.
Attorney John Morgan tweeted to Governor Rick Scott that this type of meanness will cost you the U.S. Senate seat, went on to say, grow some brass ones.
A little bit of off-the-cuff speaking there by Attorney Morgan, huh? I'd like to go on now and tell you what the National Institute on Drug Abuse is. That's NIDA, N-I-D-A. It's a United States federal government research institute. And I'm going to give you a brief history of NIDA because, well, we think that this is important to understand because it is a U.S. government operation.
In 1974, NIDA was established as part of the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration.
18 years later, in October of 1992, NIDA became part of the National Institute of Health, the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Now, you can go right to their page using this shortcut code, www.bit.ly/ NIDA Crisis, NIDACRISIS. Every day, more than 115 people in the United States die after overdosing on opioids. The misuse of and addiction to opioids, including prescription pain relievers, heroin, and synthetic opioids such as fentanyl, is a serious national crisis, and it's affecting public health as well as social and economic welfare. The Center for Disease Control estimates that the total economic burden of prescription opioid abuse in the United States is just below $80 billion. Now, how did this happen? Well, according to NIDA, in the late 1990s, opioid overdose rates began to rise. Again, according to NIDA, in 2015, more than 33,000 Americans died as a result of an opioid overdose, including prescription opioids, heroin, and illicitly manufactured fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opioid. Now, before you take these numbers as gospel, let me tell you about the use of statistics and numbers in determining cause and effect. I often see advertisements in store windows on the TV and radio, and in print. For example, listen to these.
Up to 40% off on new 2017 Nissan Sentras.
So some items are up to 90% off.
They sell for up to 95% off the original value.
Petstock's up to 100% off sale is running this Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
We have just heard several ads to the public announcing sales up to 40% off, up to 90, 95, and even 100% off.
Are any of us really so naive as to believe that we are likely to get all our items that we purchase at these fantastic discounts? Now, we understand these to be akin to the infamous dog and pony shows. You know, a dog and pony show or a highly promoted, often overstaged performance or presentation or event is intended to sway or convince opinion for political or commercial ends?
Of course, the presenter or announcer could be lying or could actually be telling the truth.
But what is the truth? For example, in the ad for pet products, selling it up to 100% off, to be truthful, all they need is one product. In fact, all they need is one single item of that product that's free to be truthful.
They could be selling 1,000 cars at full price and have one car at 90% off and still be telling the truth.
So be careful in whatever you hear or what you think you hear.
Let's get back to NIDA. Remember, they are a federal government research institute.
In a revised March 2018 memorandum, they stated that an estimated 2 million people in the United States suffered from substance abuse disorders related to prescription opioid pain relievers, and 591,000 suffered from a heroin use disorder. Not mutually exclusive here.
Look at that phrase, related to prescription opioid pain relievers.
What does that mean?
Does this imply that 2 million people in the U.S. that are actually being treated for chronic pain suffer from substance use disorders?
Or does it include those taking the prescription opioid pain relievers with or without a prescription, legally or illegally taking prescription drugs? Could we still be truthful if the actual fact was that one person being prescribed the medications was actually suffering from substance abuse disorder, and 1,999,999 were illegally taking prescription drugs and suffered from substance abuse disorders?
Maybe it's the opposite, and only one person illegally using prescribed medications was actually suffering from substance use disorder.
The point here is that information, or let us call it disinformation, is often used to confuse many people in the believing of a statement that is not, in fact, a fact.
According to NIDA, somewhere between 21 to 29% of patients prescribed opioids for chronic pain misuse them, and only 8 to 12% develop an opioid use disorder.
An estimated 4 to 6% who misuse prescription opioids transition to heroin. About 80% of people who use heroin first misused prescription opioids. Are these the same statements? Several weeks ago, this led to a lot of confusion as even the media tended to exaggerate and promulgate the information that 80% of people who use heroin first misused prescription opioids, a fact that, although it may be true, was being bandied about to create an illusion that the fact was that 80% who misused prescription opioids transitioned to heroin, rather than the true fact that only 4 to 6% do. Point blank. In one of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' speeches, he used this exact statement. He said that about 80% of people who use heroin first misuse prescription opioids. But what most people heard was that 80% of people who used prescription drugs went on to use heroin.
I mean, people need to take some aspirin sometimes and tough it out a little bit. But, I mean, a lot of people, you can get through these things.
Sometimes you just need to take two Buffering or something, go to bed. And the DEA said that a huge percentage of the heroin addiction starts with prescription. That may be an exaggerated number. They had it as high as 80%.
Take some aspirin and tough it out. Thank you, Dr. Sessions.
That was one reporter's take on this. In the 1940s, Carl Hempel, a logician, proposed what is now called the Hempel's Paradox, or also called the Raven Paradox, and it's used to illustrate a contradiction between something called inductive logic and intuition. Let's start with the assumption that all ravens are black. Actually, it's more than an assumption, since by definition, a raven is a large, all-black bird.
We can then, from that statement, say that with certainty If something is not black, then it is not a raven.
I could then say that my pet raven is black. Assuming I have a pet raven, then we know that it is black, since all ravens by definition are black. The fact that my raven is black gives us even more evidence that all ravens are black.
And here is the final statement. I have a green apple which is not black, and it is not a raven.
Therefore, if something is not black, then it is not a raven. So since this statement is equivalent to the first statement that all ravens are black, it follows that the sight of a green apple is further evidence supporting the notion that all ravens are black. What makes this inference so paradoxical is because it implies that information has been gained about ravens by looking at an apple.
Something similar, but incorrect, can also be seen in the following two statements.
All ravens are birds, all blackbirds are ravens, and that leads to the supposition that all birds are black. And we'll leave you with that. We are going to continue for a bit, though, in the discussion from last week of skin parasites. That is, those bugs that attack our skin. The first is cutaneous larva migrans. It's time for our mid-show break, so Carmen and I'll be back in just a moment.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Carmen and I ended the first part of the show by mentioning cutaneous larva migrans. And we'll continue for a bit. That is, those bugs that attack our skin. The first, as we said, is cutaneous larva migrans.
This happens to be a hookworm that normally lives in the intestines of dogs, cats, and other animals.
Now, there are human intestinal hookworms such as Ancylostoma and Necator, which we usually group together when we talk about human hookworms that attack us from inside our bodies.
Another name for cutaneous larva migraines is creeping eruption, and some people even call it ground itch or sandworms.
Its Latin name literally means wandering larvae in the skin. So let's start with the animal, be it a dog or cat, poops on the ground or on sand. The worms deposit their eggs or larvae, which then, around 1 or 2 weeks later, hitch a ride on whatever skin comes in contact with them, be it a foot or other part of your skin.
The larvae then burrow down, penetrating the outer layer of the skin called the epidermis. This creates the itchy, squiggly, burrow-like red lines on your skin. Scratching them can cause bacterial infection.
So if you see these, how are they treated? Well, you could use ivermectin or albendazole, and these are oral medications. Now, thiabendazole is another medication that can actually be taken by mouth or applied over the lesions locally.
A simple prevention may be to wear appropriate clothing and always use shoes when you may come in contact with them, such as a sandy beach.
Then there's scabies, caused by a mite called Sarcopus scabae. You know, the first thing I thought when I saw one of these under the microscope was that I was looking at a miniature spider. After all, they both have 8 legs.
You a man, Bojangles, and it dance for you in worn-out shoes.
That was a clip from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band doing Bojangles. But before we get to the nitty-gritty on scabies, let me tell you some interesting facts about that bug. First, here's some key points about scabies.
The larva can live without a human host for 48 to 72 hours. Also, the rash and itching experienced by those with scabies is a result of the body's allergic reaction to the mites, their eggs, and their waste.
The average person infested with scabies will have 15 to 20 mites present. Now, each year, scabies affects millions of people of all races, ages, and socioeconomic status.
It is highly contagious, being easily spread through close physical contact and by sharing bedding, clothing, and furniture infested with mites.
If you get scabies, then you're one in 300 million humans worldwide who get it each year. And that includes 1 million people in the United States.
If this is your first time in contact with the mite, then it could take up to 2 to 6 weeks for symptoms to appear. But this time frame is significantly shorter in subsequent infestation as the body's immune system is quicker to react, typically within 1 to 4 days.
Itching is often intense, and it's worse at night. And that's one of the most common scabies symptoms. Then there's the rash. When the mite burrows into the skin, it forms burrow tracks or lines, which are most commonly found in the skin folds.
They can look like hives, bites, knots, pimples, or even patches of scaly skin. Sometimes even blisters may also be present.
Scratching can infect the skin, and you can get a second bacterial infection, such as impetigo, and that's due to Staphylococcus aureus.
Crusty scabies, also known as Norwegian scabies, is a form of severe scabies in which hundreds to thousands of mites and maggots are harbored within skin crust, causing severe skin symptoms.
Most often, those affected with crusted scabies exhibit widespread, gray, thick, crumbling crusts. Mites living in the detached crusts can live for upwards of a week without needing human contact due to the food provided by the crusts themselves.
The most common site of infestation in adult and older children is in between the fingers, around fingernails, armpits, waistline, inner parts of the wrist, inner elbow, soles of the feet, the breast, particularly the areas around the nipples, male genitalia, buttocks, knees, and shoulder blade.
Infants may also show the lesions in their scalp, face, and neck, as well as the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. Now remember that scabies is highly contagious, so anyone living with a patient diagnosed with the condition or who has close contact with the patient will most likely be recommended to receive treatment for scabies, even if they do not have any symptoms.
Doctors generally treat scabies with topical medications such as 5% permethrin cream, clotrimazole cream, or lidocaine lotion.
In some cases, a 25% benzoate lotion or 10% sulfur ointment can be used. Now, most topical preparations are applied at night and washed off in the morning. Ivermectin, an oral medication, may be recommended for people who are immunocompromised, those with the crusted scabies, or those who just did not respond to the topical therapy.
Ivermectin should not be used during pregnancy or while breastfeeding, nor by children weighing less than 33 pounds.
Other medications, such as antihistamines, anti-itching lotions like Pramoxin lotion, and steroid creams can be prescribed, and those offer relief from symptoms.
Treatment with prescribed medication will generally kill mites quickly. The itching and rash may initially become worse.
You want to hear a Guinness Book of Records? One adult bed bug lasted a record 550 days without a blood meal.
We all know that bed bugs are hard to eliminate because they can hide in tiny cracks and crevices. And obviously, they are difficult to starve.
Keeping bedding and living spaces clean is a good idea, but cleanliness has little to do with bed bugs. A good piece of advice is, if you do not want bed bugs, never bring home used furniture from the street or secondhand mattresses or even overstuffed furniture.
A variety of controlled treatments are used, including insecticides and diatom measures, earth. High temperatures over 103 degrees Fahrenheit have also been found to reduce or even destroy bed bug infestations.
Yesterday, I was invited to answer questions on medical marijuana on WJCT Radio, a PBS station. Apparently, there are many people in Florida that are simply upset that smokable marijuana has not been legalized as a choice for those that have the qualifying diagnosis to receive medical marijuana. Hopefully for those, the governor's appeal to continue the ban on smoking marijuana will be denied. As many of my patients know, I have recently changed my diet to a vegan one. Currently in the United States, vegetarianism and veganism are steadily becoming more popular. Many studies have demonstrated that restricting meat impacts the body in a number of positive ways.
For example, a plant-based diet has been shown to reduce the risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome.
And vegetarianism as well as veganism may even protect against certain cancers. A recent review that's now been published in the journal Progress in Cardiovascular Disease focused on the benefits of a plant-based diet on cardiovascular health specifically. The researchers in Washington, D.C., scrutinized recent relevant studies. They concluded for individuals following a plant-based diet that
risk of death from cardiovascular disease is reduced by 40%, as is coronary heart disease risk.
Also, blocked arteries are unblocked partially or fully in as many as 91% of patients. Hypertension risk was found to drop by 34%. And total cholesterol, as well as the low-density lipoprotein, also what I call the bad cholesterol, these levels are much lower in vegetarians compared with non-vegetarians. Moreover, a plant-based diet was shown to be associated with weight loss. So how does a plant-based diet help the heart? Well, first, plants impart some benefits while meat increases certain risks. For example, plants are rich in fiber and polynutrients, as well as phytonutrients, which are known to reduce inflammation and oxidative stress. Also, animal products are often high in fat, cholesterol, and environmental pollutants, as well as they do seem to increase inflammation. Remember, heart disease is responsible for the deaths of more than 600,000 U.S. individuals each and every year, and it remains the leading cause of death globally. However, these findings show that if society could be at least nudged towards plant-based diets and away from excessive meat consumption, humanity's heart health could be substantially improved. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com. where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.